Sometimes going to the grocery store can be chaotic. There doesn't seem to be enough time to check the list, make sure everything is there, search for the best prices, and take the time to make sure you get the best quality meat. So let ButcherBox help you out. Giving you peace of mind, ButcherBox delivers high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust straight to your door. No grocery carts required. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or hormones, 100% grass-fed, free-range, and crate-free. What more can you ask for? What about free shipping, customized box plans, exclusive member deals, recipe inspirations, tips, and tricks? You really can't go wrong with ButcherBox. Sign up at butcherbox.com/morningcup and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/morningcup and use code morningcup to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Today's podcast is brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate destination for exploring the mysteries of the past. If you're fascinated by true crime, get ready to dive into the stories that made headlines. Newspapers.com offers a billion pages of historical newspapers from the U.S. and beyond, and you can search the entire collection in seconds. Their vast newspaper collection is a goldmine for eyewitness accounts, crime scene photos, news reports, and more. Whether you're interested in famous crimes or long-forgotten cases, Newspapers.com gives you a front-row seat to more than 300 years of history. For our listeners, Newspapers.com has a special offer. Use the code CUPOFMURDER for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code CUPOFMURDER at Newspapers.com. Sign up today and start unraveling the true crime mysteries that keep you up at night.
There were two more murders 15 miles away.
When police arrived, they found the telephones and electricity lines.
We have a weird homicide.
A scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird...
Morning.
Cup of murder.
Some cases, unfortunately, have so little information that it is likely the mystery will never be solved. On March 29th, 2011... an identity was given in a decade-long cold case, and with that came the hope that the case would finally be solved. Yet, as of now, it remains a cold case. So if you like your coffee hot but your bones chilled, sit back and start your day with a morning cup of murder. While citizens of London watched as the U.S. dealt with the immediate aftermath of the devastating 9/11 attacks, the city found itself overcome by a strange sort of quiet that, just 10 days after the towers fell, would be interrupted by a horrific discovery. Aidan Minter, while walking across the Tower Bridge in the central part of the city, looked over to the water and saw what he thought was a tailor's mannequin floating towards the bridge. It wasn't until it started to make its way under him that he noticed a series of wounds that could only mean one thing. That what he was seeing on the River Thames was, in fact, the dismembered body of a human being. By the time police were able to pull the body from the water, it made its way close to the famed Globe Theater. Later dubbed Adam by the officers, the unidentified remains belonged to a black male aged somewhere between 8 and 4 years of age. Appearing to have been in the water for about 10 days, wearing a pair of orange girl shorts, the young victim's cause of death was likely from the deep slice to his throat. But what seemed to be the most devastating part of the discovery was that his arms, legs, and head had all been expertly amputated from his torso. Even now, none of these pieces have ever been found. There were no signs of sexual or physical abuse, and there were indications that, prior to his murder, the young boy had been fed pretty well. Looking at the sole piece of evidence they had at the time, the shorts, investigators soon learned that the brand, size, and color could only be found in a small number of shops in Germany. But other than that, there really wasn't much else that they could glean from Adam's torso. About a week later, desperate for more information, detectives appealed for help from the public and showcased the story on the BBC's Crime Watch program. And though the move did result in about 60 calls, none resulted in any kind of breakthrough. Neither did the £50,000 reward. Now, while investigators continued working the case, a post-mortem was performed on the body and determined that, prior to his throat being sliced and drained of his blood, young Adam had been poisoned by someone who clearly had enough experience to dismember the body with expert precision. Further forensic testing showed, through stomach contents, that the boy had cough syrup in his system, river clay, traces of gold and quartz, and ash. There were also indications that the boy had only been in the UK for a few days or weeks before being murdered. And in testing that clay and sediment, they found that he likely came from the southwestern Nigeria area near Benin City, which just so happens to be the birthplace of voodoo. Wondering now if this was a ritualistic killing, and wondering if the medicine was given to the boy because he was sick or to simply make him drowsy, some experts theorize that he might have been the victim of witch doctors who use body parts as ingredients for clients who want things like luck or better finances. This is called a Muti killing. The only problem with this particular theory, though, is that most Muti killings take place in southern Africa, leading some to discredit this particular line of thinking. Others believe the boy might have been a human sacrifice for a more twisted version of the Yoruban belief system in Nigeria, and that he may have been an offering to the goddess Oshun, a deity associated with the river, water, and fertility. Which makes sense considering where Adam's torso was found. Regardless of which theory people believed, it was clear to police that, if they were true, it meant that Adam was likely trafficked to Britain for the purpose of whatever ritual or sacrifice took place. Smuggled into a new country at a devastatingly young age for the sole purpose of being killed. Unable to find a match for the boy in any databases for missing children in both Britain and Europe, investigators continued to ask the public for assistance. But because of its proximity to the 9/11 attacks in the U.S., the story only received moderate publicity, and it didn't even make its way into the Nigerian media. By 2002, officers were ready to get some answers and flew to Johannesburg, South Africa, around the time that Nelson Mandela made his own public appeal for any information relevant to Adam's case. The appeal was broadcast all over Africa and even translated into a number of tribal languages, including Yoruba. In 2003, London Metropolitan Police, back in South Africa, consulted with detectives and Muti experts, who suggested that the orange shorts might have meant that the boy was related to at least one of his killers, and that the choice of color was likely a way to apologize to his soul and pray that he might resurrect. With this information, police traveled to Nigeria and launched a campaign to track down Adam's parents. But despite visiting local elementary schools and searching the missing children's records, there was nothing that could help point them to their victim's true identity. While police continued to make their public pleas for information, and more small details on the case were being unearthed slowly but surely, a seemingly unrelated report came in that would lead police on what was either a wild goose chase or a pathway straight to the identity of Adam. In July 2002, a woman in Glasgow named Joyce Osajid attracted the attention of local social workers, and later, the investigators trying to solve Adam's case. Joyce was in her 30s, was originally from Benin City, Nigeria, and was seeking asylum in the UK along with her two young daughters. Placed in an apartment in the area, social workers grew concerned when, after visiting their home, they found a number of items that they described as, quote, bizarre ritualistic objects. According to their records, Joyce had a history of mental health problems and used to be involved in sex work. So when they saw the strange items and the clear signs of neglect in her daughters, they decided that the girls needed to be removed from her custody and taken somewhere safer. In order to do so, they had to have a court hearing, and Joyce had to attend. When she did, she, quote, made a scene and began screaming about cults and ritual sacrifices. Her daughters were taken into foster care, and Joyce, when the story got out, caught the attention of PC Jim Miglin, a man who had been following the Adam case in London. He got in touch with the homicide unit and, relaying all the information he knew about Joyce and that court hearing, DS Nick Chalmers, who had been working the case since the very beginning, traveled to Glasgow and got a warrant to search the flat. Inside, he found a number of clothing pieces with that same German label as the shorts found on Adam, and even some in the same size as the pair he was wearing. This was enough for him to request an interview with Joyce, but when spoken to this time, she appeared confused and said she didn't know anything about the boy who was found in the river. Disappointed, the officers let Joyce go, but he was convinced that she knew more than she was saying, and because of that, when her application for asylum was rejected 4 months later and he heard the news, he knew it would be too hard to locate her once she was sent back to Nigeria, so they chartered a private jet to make the journey with her. Unfortunately, Joyce offered them nothing on the flight, and once back in Africa, she went completely off the radar. But it turned out that her deportation wasn't the dead end that they feared it would be. Now inquiring with German police about Joyce, officers reached out to London detectives to let them know that, until late 2001, she had actually been living in Hamburg, the same city where the orange shorts were purchased. Remembering how, upon arresting her, she only had two contacts in her phone, officers decide to reach out to a man named Moussa Kamara and track him down at his home in London. They were also able to learn his real name, Kingsley Ojo. He, too, was brought in for an interview, but again, nothing of worth came from it, and he, like Joyce, was released but not forgotten. Convinced he was part of a human trafficking operation, Kingsley was placed under surveillance, and sure enough, was spotted talking to a group of known criminals involved in a developing operation just hours after they released him. The group had, at the time, been planning on smuggling Nigerians into the UK. Biding their time, in July of 2003, after 6 months of surveillance, the police carried out raids on 9 different addresses across London and arrested a total of 21 individuals, including Kingsley Ojo. All the while, the analysis of Adam's stomach contents were still ongoing. Finding pollen samples from Southeast England, they were sent off for analysis and found that one plant was a calabar bean. Also sometimes referred to as the doomsday plant, it is traditionally used in witchcraft ceremonies in West Africa, and when ingested, would have paralyzed the young boy, but would not have relieved him of any pains inflicted. The other plant was identified as the ground-up seeds of a datura plant, sometimes referred to as devil's trumpet, and causes hallucinations and delirium. It seemed that the more they found out about Adam, the more they learned about the absolute horrors he suffered before his death. Because if their theory was correct, it meant that the boy was given both plants to ingest before his throat was slit, meaning he was paralyzed but awake during the whole ordeal. In December of 2004, an inquest into the death came back with a verdict of unlawful killing, around the time that Kingsley Ojo contacted investigators from his jail cell and offered some information. He claimed he had secret recordings of Joyce Asajid recorded in Nigeria by some associates and offered his help in tracking down the killer to clear his own name. Released in late 2005, he spent the next 2 years feeding police information, including the fact that Joyce was on her way back to the UK. This proved to be false, as did his claims that a different woman led a sacrificial ceremony back in September of 2001. Realizing that he could not be trusted and still believed to be using a false identity to commit benefit fraud, in 2008, Kingsley was deported back to Nigeria. Then Joyce reappeared suddenly, and police rushed to interview her yet again. This time, she admitted that she looked after the young boy that they called Adam while living in Hamburg, Germany, and even admitted to purchasing him those orange shorts, but revealed nothing about his murder before vanishing yet again. Still at a loss, officers continued the investigation, and 3 years later, got the opportunity to search a number of items that Joyce allegedly left with a friend in Germany. Amongst the items was a photograph of a young boy who appeared to be about 5 years old. The picture was taken in 2001, the same year that Adam's body was found. And in early 2011, the photo was given to ITV News in hopes of, once again, tracking down Joyce for questioning. When they did, she said the photo was indeed of the boy that they were looking for and that his real name was Ik Pamosa. He was the boy she cared for in Germany, as previously stated, and she told investigators the last time she saw him was when she handed him off to a man called Bawa. For a while, it seemed like they finally got the break that they needed in the decades-long case. But when searching for the six-year-old boy whose parents were deported back to Nigeria, they were unable to identify him or move the case any further forward. Then, in February of 2013, Joyce contacted the BBC and said she finally ready to tell the entire story. This time, she said the boy's real name was Patrick Erhabor, and that Bawa, the man she handed the boy over to that day, was in fact Kingsley Ojo. Claiming she wrongly identified a photograph that had been circulating the press as Patrick, when it was really a friend's living son, when police heard these new claims, they feared her declining mental state and treated the revelations as false. Therefore, Adam, to this day, remains officially unidentified. And as of 2013, the case became a cold one. Joyce has since passed away. The last update in the case came in September of 2021, when a renewed appeal was made for members of the public to, quote, be bold and come forward with any information that could help solve the case. As far as I can tell, nothing has changed, and Adam's identity remains a mystery. Thank you for joining me in my morning cup of murder. Please join me again tomorrow to hear what terrible thing happened on March 30th. Don't forget to rate and subscribe and let me know how you like it. If you want to help support the podcast, there is always Patreon or just sharing it with your true crime obsessed friends. And remember, stay safe.